huge weekend, Josh.
Massive.
Huge weekend. Grand finalists decided in the A-League. European teams making pundits look like absolute morons, specifically Turkey. We'll get into that later. And a few little transfer tidbits here and there, plus a big, big preview of a massive FFA Cup clash with you will be calling.
Ooh, we've been waiting for this one for so, so long. I can't believe it's actually going to happen. Behind closed doors is a massive shame, and that's causing havoc for all sorts of big fixtures coming up, Lockie. But Preston versus Oakley at Lakeside tomorrow night, 7:30, live streamed with Teo Pelletieri, the dulcet tones of Teo on the play-by-play. I'll be doing special comments. I really cannot wait. But I guess the big question is, what happens with the A-League Grand Final, Lockie? It's Grand Final week. We don't even know if it's happening this week and at which ground.
It kind of sounds like we need an expert opinion on this, doesn't
it? I think so.
You mentioned the phrase big fixtures before, and we have a big fixture joining us on the line right now. None other than Fox Sports' Adam Peacock. Adam, a warm welcome to you.
Big fixture. I'm walking around suburbia in Sydney at night while my son's at his training session, and I'm wearing tracksuit pants and a hoodie.
Well, I look like I'm about to put the bins out. You're a big fixture to us, Adam. It means a lot. But you were across all of the action from the weekend, Sydney and Melbourne City both booking their spots in the A-League Grand Final. Does it have a sense of irony to you that after this wondrous season we've had that's been oh so competitive, we end up with the two grand finalists from last year?
A little bit of irony in that. In the sense that, yeah, that, okay, we're back to, it seems, where we were last season, but the way we got there was totally different. The way that the young players have come out, I saw a stat from Andrew Howe, the king of stats, call him, in Australian football, saying that 40% of goals have been scored by young players, young Australian players, this final series. That never happened before. So that's a little snapshot of what has happened for the entirety of the season. These young players have got a chance, and best possible actual situation that's occurred was yesterday's semi-final with those two young boys up front for Melbourne City who've come in because they've got their opportunity with other guys either injured or away, and they take them with some brilliant football. So that for me has been the highlight, and that is what I'm looking forward to on the weekend. What younger player, because Sydney have been robbed of their depth as well, what younger player is going to stand up and make a name for himself to put a cap on this season, what has been the season of the young player?
Well, Adam, Melbourne City have essentially been forced to turn to Kolakowski and Tilio and Rafael Borges Rodriguez in the absence of their Socceroos contingent and Craig Noone getting injured in the warm-up over the weekend. I actually think given the form of Tilio and Kolakowski, you know, it's obviously tough to replace a guy like Jamie McLaren, but I haven't knocked them down, you know, as many pegs as I thought I might based on the performance on the weekend.
Well, that was the unknown when those two that we thought we were going to lose in the boot and McLaren up front for Melbourne City were going to go with the Socceroos. It turned out that Andrew Naboot injured himself, so he didn't go, but he's still out. And Craig Noone injured himself, and he's got issues. And Nathaniel Atkinson, thankfully for City, has come back in and given a bit of depth there, even though he's been used as a right-back early in the season. But the great unknown, it wasn't a given that they'd lose a lot, but the assumption was that they're going to struggle a bit more than they ordinarily would without those guys. And what would Tilio and Kolakowski bring? Well, yesterday, against a couple of damn good defenders in Milligan and also Shushnyar and Franjic on the right, even though he started on the left, caused them problems. So, yeah, they fit in well, and they didn't lose anything there. Remains to be seen what happens in the grand final.
And there was they haven't just been making waves on the pitch, off it as well, because there was that great roundtable discussion that you, Bozza, Harps had with the two of them. It's great to see these young players coming through, not just showing what they can do on the park, but you know, showing a real zeal off it in front of the camera as well.
Yeah, that's important. Absolutely important to connect with people their age. I'm way beyond that. You're a lot closer than me to their ages, but to have that relatability to a lot of young players involved in Australian football, that's really important, and to have that personality. And Kolakowski has a bit about him. Obviously, he did something he probably shouldn't have late in that game when he started carrying on a bit, but I think Tilio's a bit more reserved. But we need those bigger characters who won't mind coming on and showing a bit.
Tilio really excites me, Adam, not just, you know, for City's grand final chances, but going forward as a real developmental prospect. I mean, Kolakowski is kind of more of a straightforward play, very exciting, but, you know, gets in behind, scores goals, whereas Tilio is just so creative. You know, the Arzani comparison is probably a lazy one, and whenever I try and hype this kid up on Twitter, I get people telling me, you know, oh, it's a small sample size, Arzani's got too big for his boots, look where he is now. But I'm just so excited by Tilio. There was one touch against Victory in the last regular season game where he did a little Iniesta move but also controlled the ball with it. It was his first touch at the same time and left Adama Traore for dead. I just think he's something else.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he's obviously got improvement, and Melbourne City know his faults more than ever, or more than anyone, and they're working on those faults to get him out of his game. We don't see him regularly enough in training to pick apart those faults and have a discussion about it. But what we do see is a very talented footballer, and a footballer that Sydney FC, we now know why Sydney FC weren't happy at all when he left. They were filthy that he left to go down to Melbourne City. They thought that, okay, you're going to be in an environment where you're training with the best of the best in the A-League, and Ninkovic is that, and, you know, Bomjohan's a pretty good player, and Caceres and Bratton and all those guys, thinking that, yeah, you just be patient, you're going to get your time. But obviously what Melbourne City put in front of him on their brochure was much more appealing, and now we can see why Sydney were filthy. And, yeah, this kid, I actually bumped into one of his ex-school coaches in the crowd yesterday, and he was at school playing in an open competition, so with year 12 boys, he was in year 8 and carving. He was sent out there, he was the runt of the litter like he is pretty much now, but still he was carving up when he was giving 4 years to some boys in high school. So yeah, you can see there's obvious talent there. It'll be exciting to see where he ends up, but hopefully the next few career choices that he makes are the best for his football and nothing else, because you can see that Daniel Arzani, he's made a couple of career choices. Maybe it's not his fault. Maybe it is his fault. Maybe it's his agent, not sure. But they haven't worked out for him. Okay, he got a bad ACL, but hopefully a guy like Tilio can get the right minutes at the right club in the next 2 to 3 years to see him really end up. Who knows where he'll end up.
Well, it was that dynamic duo that got Melbourne City their spot in the grand final, at the expense, of course, of MacArthur. What did you make, looking back on the Bulls' first season in the A-League? What have you made of them and their controversial
Cowbells? Yeah, pretty good. Yeah, the Cowbells are an interesting welcome to Campbelltown when you live where I live in Sydney and you've got to drive 2 hours to get to their ground. It's not exactly the one thing that you want to listen to when you walk up, but rock up. But that's the way it goes. Yeah, they've been good. I've grown more fond of them as the season's gone on. It was like, okay, Campbelltown, it is basically a growing area. I think there's the demographic is that there's about 150 people a week move into that area to settle out there, because the greater Sydney area, closer to CBD, is too expensive and people want a bit of fresh air out there. But it's growing and they're ambitious. I mean, they've got Davila next season. Looks like they got Craig Noon. They're pretty keen on Danny De Silva. That might be announced soon as well. I think the players that they got there this season, Mark Milligan's obviously going. I'm not entirely sure how many of their foreign contingent will stick around for their second season. But they've got a coach who knows what he's doing backwards. They've got a staff who knows what they're doing. They've got a front office who are kind of growing into the job and working it all out from an A-League perspective. I think it's a pretty good look. Look, put it this way. The way that Western United are going at the moment as a club and the way that MacArthur are going, I think MacArthur are a step or two ahead.
Well, Adam, the challenge for all these new expansion clubs is finding some sort of identity. And, I mean, yeah. MacArthur playing in all whites, outspending the competition and pinching talent, hoovering up talent from their competitors. It's almost the Campbelltown Galacticos they're assembling for next year.
Little bit. I'm not sure. The word Galacticos probably doesn't get bounced around in Campbelltown too often. Truth be told, but they do have an identity. They've got their crowd's got an identity with the Cowbells. Someone ripped a flare last night, and some of their fans started punching on. You don't really have an identity as a fan group until you start doing that in the A-League. So, no. But in all seriousness, with the football, they've got an academy that they're building out there. They've got some land they're going to build there, and they're going to have an imprint in the community, which is good. They don't really have that on a day-to-day basis at the moment because they train at Fairfield, but which is a bit in. It's like half an hour away from or 45 from Campbelltown, but. The identity is a crucial thing, because we've seen with Western United that there is something there with Western United, but you can't truly have an identity if you don't have a home base. And they need a stadium big style. And that's why I said that Macarthur are a step or two ahead, because mainly based on the fact that there's no damn stadium for Western United to play in at the moment. It's just going to hold them back.
Well, what was the atmosphere like at that semi-final, Adam? Because there was a lot made of the decision by the APL to move the game. A lot of people would have preferred, for the sporting integrity of the competition, for Melbourne City to have played behind closed doors at Amy, or tried to find a solution to play it in regional Victoria. But do you think it was worth it to move the game for the crowd that assembled? And certainly the players' families were out in force.
Well, the Tilios liked it, because there was about 35 of them there. Kolakowski had a few cousins as well. Look, it was hard. It was like choices M and N. If you want to go down from A, B, C, D and E, it was, in retrospect, probably closed doors would be better, because they were for the integrity of it all, for the look of it all, and basically to say to the Victorian government, look, you're being a bit ridiculous here, because the night before, or two nights before, you had 7,000 people sitting on each other's laps an hour out of Melbourne, and you're not going to allow people into this. It's, yeah, hopefully it gets worked out for this week. It wasn't the worst of a bad situation, but it wasn't far off. It just had a bit of an empty feel to it, to be truthful, at Cogra there. But I throw no blame at organisers in a great way about it, because it is so difficult. You're beholden to government decisions and health advice decisions, which are way beyond anyone's control, as we've seen.
Yeah, it was interesting and pretty helpful, actually, to hear Greg O'Rourke sort of rationalise and explain the methodology behind the decision when spoke to him last night.
Yeah, that's the one thing that the league, hopefully going forward, and the FFA haven't been very good at in the past few years, that the explanations to the fan. You can brief the media all you want. You can tell us in a phone call all you want and hope that we get the message out, which happens from time to time. It happens in all walks. But you need to front up. You need to explain in detail to fans and give a rational decision, because 95% of fans will cop the rational decision. They might not agree with it, but it's not like we're dealing with a bunch of idiots who are going to set flame to your car if you don't like the decision. Just explain to it, to get people who invest in your sport on your page and understand why you've made those decisions. And hopefully going forward, Greg O'Rourke and the crew, Greg's a great guy. I just don't think he's been helped a lot over the years, and particularly people who have been running the FFA, about how to communicate properly. Now, the FFA now, or FA, what do you call them, got Peter Philopoulos, who's a good operator. He's going to get the message, and I can already see the messaging from James Johnson from the FA's point of view. There's been a noticeable twist since James has been in the job, which is good, because fans just want to know. And if you don't let them know, they'll just give up or just start paying less attention than what they are. And football, quite frankly, especially the A-League and the W-League, can't afford that in this country.
Yeah, I just don't think, Adam, that people know who Greg O'Rourke is. I don't think people know what the APL is, by and large, outside of this sort of insular media circles we operate in. I see a lot of commentary online saying, oh, this FFA decision is a disgrace, you know, which has nothing to do with it whatsoever. But when Greg O'Rourke actually is put in front of a mic and speaks, I've always been quite impressed by him. I remember, you know, there was I think it was Around the Block did this sort of State of the Game special with some of you guys at Fox and Greg O'Rourke talking about, you know, fan culture and active support and all those sorts of issues. And actually listening to that and listening to him explain the sort of behind the scenes decision-making and the factors at play was incredible and really opened my eyes and made me think that the issues were a lot more complicated than sometimes the fan on the streets or in the stands gives them credit for.
They're almost, over the years, I've found that they're almost too worried about what people think. You can't be that worried. Just go out and tell people what's happening. Mm. It's not like we're dealing with, you know, the briefcase of the codes of the nuclear armament that the US government have. We're talking about football here. It's not that important to everyone's day-to-day livelihoods. It's important for people who play, professional players and the like, but I'm talking about the people who enjoy watching it. And yes, they're so passionate about it, but you can't hide things on a consistent basis. Or not hide. When I say hide, I shouldn't say that. I said not tell. There's a difference between hiding and not telling. Mm. And I think sometimes that football just doesn't tell because, for whatever reason, they don't think it's important enough, or they don't think that the people out there need to hear it or whatever. I think just put as much as you can out there, which in general is a lot, and let people decide for themselves. Like rugby league, for instance, do this thing on a Monday. This is just a small thing. Rugby league every Monday, Graham Annesley, the guy that runs the competition for the NRL, he gets up there and does a half an hour webinar, basically, on the decisions of the weekend and why they made those decisions. So there's great clarity. It doesn't stop people blowing up, but it adds to the conversation and adds to the understanding of people out there about exactly what's going on. I'd like to see more of it in football at every level, not just in decision-making processes on the field with referees, but other things as well.
Meanwhile, in the A-League, we get moments where we don't even know how long a player is going to be suspended for, like Adama Traore.
And then when you get the email to say how long it's been suspended for, you need a friggin' master's in law to work out what the language in the email that you're getting. It just should say Adama Traore has been suspended for 4 matches because he did something he shouldn't have, for instance. But, yeah, they go into this great detail and, yeah, speaking another language. Anyway. Yeah.
Well, I think you've got to take this idea and run with it, Adam. The Gregor Rourke weekly webinar needs to be a thing. Needs to be a thing. But he did throw up a couple of options with respect to what's going to happen to the upcoming grand final. We know that there's potential to play it in Melbourne and ideally play it in Melbourne in front of a reduced capacity crowd. There's been offers from other states to have the game in a neutral venue. Also thrown up was the idea of delaying the game by a week and potentially giving the chance for some Socceroos to come out of quarantine and play in that game.
Yep.
What's your personal preference of all of the options that were thrown up?
The lowest is take it somewhere else. I think you need to, if you can't have it in Melbourne, you have it in Sydney. And if you can't have it in Sydney, then you take it somewhere else. But between all of that, I think anywhere north of 40% crowd capacity allowed in Melbourne, you have it there. If the Victorian government say 25%, you delay it a week, and then you just get the play. I'm sure players are not going to walk away because their contract has expired 3 days before the game from the possibility of playing in a grand final. The tax implications might be a bit difficult with the end of the financial year, so I don't know how you weave through that. But to not have the best possible outcome because you're worried about 3 days of contract would pretty much sum up a lot of things about Australian sport and Australian society at the moment, because it seems that rules supersede common sense 9 times out of 10. I'd do everything you can, bend over backwards, to have at least 40% capacity at Amy Park. And if you can't, delay it a week. And then if your week is still burnt up and you've still got the same situation in Victoria, come up to Sydney and play the game. That's what I'd do.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, Adam. I mean, after moving the semi-final, it would be really harsh to play the grand final in Sydney if we can avoid that at sort of any cost to give Melbourne City the home ground advantage that they've earned and deserved this season. But we haven't spoken much about Sydney FC. What did you make of their performance against Adelaide United? I thought going forward they were a little bit more potent, a little bit more exciting than they have been, and maybe that came at the expense of a little bit of control late in the game, but it wasn't the total typical Sydney FC suffocate the life out of the game kind of performance.
Yeah, it wasn't, because they didn't have Ninkovic, who's their best player on the ball. Who you pass in the ball, it relieves pressure around everyone around it, because you're not going to lose it. Or 95 times out of 100, you're not going to lose it. So that was key. And I think the fact that they had kids on the bench, that they didn't have the depth, where ordinarily they've been bringing off a Bumyahan off the bench, for instance, and injecting him on the hour mark. They don't have that option when they've got injuries to Ninkovic and they've got 3 Socceroos away. Paolo Retre adds depth and versatility off the bench if he's not in the starting lineup, or Caceres, for instance, who's maybe on the bench when they want to start with Retre. So I think that was the biggest issue, and they were just happy to get through the game, and it was a little tighter than they would have wanted. 3-0, if Lafondra scores his pen at the end of the section, it could have been 5. So on the whole, I think pretty really impressive performance from Sydney FC, given the circumstances.
Which side do you think sits more comfortable ahead of the grand final after what we saw this weekend?
I think Melbourne City, because they're comfortable in the knowledge that those two kids aimed up on the weekend up front, or 3 if you're throwing Atkinson, but Tilio and Kolakowski. I think, Melbourne City, and the intensity that they played at in the second half was just it replicated what they've done to so many teams this season. So, yeah, they for me are favourites going in, regardless of where the game is, in actual fact.
Well, there you go. Lockie, you might be celebrating come this weekend or next.
The only way is up from last grand final.
As long as you don't get a disallowed goal in the first few minutes.
I told you that the full time of that game, I was multiple hoods over my head on the couch for about 30 minutes, didn't move. My parents tried to speak to me. I just, leave me alone, please.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We've all been there. But Adam, in whatever way, shape or form the grand final does take, we look forward to the broadcast and you being a big part of it. Thank you very much, as always, for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No worries, guys. Have a good night.
Fox Sports, Adam Peacock. Always, always fantastic value, isn't he, Josh?
Ah, he's terrific. He's one of the best things about the A-League broadcasts over so many years has been the fact that Adam Peacock has been hosting in the halftime chats. Well, he's just got the perfect chemistry and personality for it, and he really is passionate and does think deeply about the game and the local game here, which is great. So I just want to extend my congratulations to him for such an amazing tenure in being sort of the steward of the Fox Sports coverage.
Yeah, he's done an absolute ripper job. And I didn't want to ask him this directly, but one of the comments coming through on the Twitch, do get your comments involved on the Twitch stream if you're hanging around, was from Aussie Hez. And he says that the Twitch fan wants to know if Adam is jumping ship to Paramount. Now, obviously not a question that he can answer, but hypothetically, I know that he's got other involvements, you know, in the Fox Sports network outside of football. But I wouldn't say no, Josh Parrish.
No, I definitely wouldn't.
I wouldn't say no.
I wouldn't. But I'm not sure what he's got planned. I mean, he's, you know, a multi-sport guy as well. You know, Fox have probably got other ways to use him. He's so versatile. He goes on Fox Sports News all the time. So contracts and all that are a complicating factor. But I'm sure he'd love to be involved if possible. Maybe we could get an Adam Peacock, Simon Hill reunion on the Paramount coverage. We'll see.
Well, I think we'll leave the Twitch viewers and everyone else who's listening in to ponder a potential future broadcast lineup.
We've been raided, Lockie. We've been raided by Aussie Hez's boys.
Oh, this is exciting.
So this is fantastic. Keep the interaction coming. We love your comments. We'll read some of them out after the break. We're going to talk some...
Always pog to see people come through.
Absolutely.
Get a little stream
absolutely.
Read.
Absolutely.
Good to see Serbian winger in the chat.
Absolutely popping off at the moment. So we'll get to your Twitch comments on the other side. We've got some A-League off-season news to talk about. And coming up, our big Euros breakdown of the weekend's action. Lockie is still sweating on the outcome of that Croatia-Scotland game.
I haven't slept in days. Days. It's been horrible.
So make sure you stay tuned here on Twilight Football.
Josh Parrish and Lockie Flanagan on Twilight Football. If you're watching, send help, because we're being raided. We're being raided on the Twitch stream currently by Aussie Hez and 8 others. So please do, all the Twitch viewers, even though I've been told they're 90% World of Warcraft players, keep the comments coming in anyway. Just drop a little lizard pog in the emote, you know, the new pog emote in the chat. Something like that. But Josh,
if we get enough polls, I reckon I'll try and honour our WoW rating party in my commentary on Friday.
Yeah, if we get
there's a good goal, I'll give it a WoW.
And my other personal favourite, not to be Twitch exclusive, but if you haven't used the Twitch yet, get on there. If we get enough cappers, I will sing Flower of Scotland personally on the stream after the show's over. But Josh, speaking of people who are being raided, the Central Coast Mariners. It's a sorry old time for the Central Coast Mariners. They've lost another today. Jack Clisby off to Perth.
Heartbreaking.
I mean, I actually think that Jack Clisby has been one of these players that's been maximised by Stadich.
Yeah, he's definitely been something of a punchline in recent years in the league, a bit like Mark Warren used to be, not quite that bad. But I think he's not given enough credit for what he brings. Stadich certainly likes to use him as the more advanced of the two fullbacks. He takes a lot of set pieces as well. He's actually got quite a good left foot with his crosses. So he's been trusted with sort of wide delivery of set pieces, not too many direct shots on goal. But it's certainly a huge loss for Central Coast. Not as big as losing Alan Stajic, but I suspect he's not the first to go this offseason.
No, well, I know that Rontoniuk is being linked with moves elsewhere as well. But one big move that did happen today as well that we want to bring up, just because he's a part of our collective brand, I guess you could call it that. We have stocks in him, is Dylan Wenzel-Halls, and we're now going to be able to see him in the flesh a lot more frequently because he signed for Western United, Josh.
Yeah, that is a really big departure. I think he's really dropped off in the second half of this year, I'm afraid. You know, he started so brightly, but you know, he's not the most productive attacking player in the league this season, as I thought he was going to be.
Mm.
But
well, I think like in that respect, Riku Danzaki really stole the show in the front third,
and he dropped off as well when Scott McDonald left because he didn't have that striker to play off.
Yeah.
He's really good playing passes into Scott McDonald's feet or being the third man runner when there is another player passing into Scott McDonald's feet. He was really good at running in behind off him and you know, being able to pick up that bounce pass. I do think he's going to be a good acquisition for Western United because they just needed a little bit more pressing intensity and pace in their front line. Bessart Berisha, I'm not sure where this leaves him. I think he's out of contract. I'm not sure if he's done in the A-League.
Danny Thunder.
Ooh, that would be nice. It would be a nice full circle completion of the kind of football
ever since I saw him at not Frank Holohan, at George Andrews Reserve, in that Football Belongs mini doc, I've been manifesting Bessart Berisha to the MPL Victoria with the Dandenong Thunder. I'm not sure Hamish Watson would be a huge fan, but everyone else would be. That's for sure.
That would be amazing. I mean, I think it's almost destined to happen at some point. I don't know whether Bessart Berisha thinks he's done in professional football, though. That's the thing.
We'll bring in the FFA Cup chat later, but just imagine like an old Bess, like a 30, you know, 37, 38, 39-year-old Bess playing for Dandy Thunder and causing some massive cup set against A-League opposition. Like, oh, so good. That would be so. But we'll park the FFA Cup chat for there because there's one other transfer, not confirmed, rumoured transfer that I want to mention to you, Josh, because you might get a bit of a chuckle. This one being reported by a website called, not The Onion, not the Batuta Advocate, Celtic Now and Forever. Celtic boss interested in signing lightning-fast right winger. who immediately springs to mind?
Ooh.
If you think from the A-League.
Maybe a Chris Economy.
Wrong. Elvis Campsober is the obvious answer, and he's being very legitimately linked with a move to the biggest club in Scotland. Well, in some people's opinions, the biggest
what's
club in Scotland.
What's the source quoted for this?
CelticNowAndForever.com.
They claim
They claim no source. They say Celtic could be ready to make an offer for Elvis Campsober, who currently players. No, that's not a mispronunciation. They have literally wrote players instead of plays for Australian side Melbourne Victory. As Ange Postecoglou aims to raid, he has never signed an Australian player while he was at Yokohama, his former club. It's a talent. No inverted commas there. Talent is used.
Goodness.
In a literal sense.
I think somebody's pranking them. I really think these websites will publish anything if it gets them clicks. And I think somebody has messaged them on Twitter saying they have intel and they've just run with it because they have no idea about Australian football and they've never watched Elvis Campsober play. There is no way. I mean, obviously there is no way. But it looks like slightly more plausible because he scored a few goals in kind of A-League junk time towards the end of the year.
I mean, the general consensus
is if you're just looking at his transfer market page and just this season's stats, you might go, oh, maybe, you know, he's scored a couple of goals.
I mean, the consensus is that, you know, Campsober's days may be numbered in the A-League, but I didn't think it was meant like that. I didn't realise that was the interpretation. The funny thing about this article, not just the hilarity of the actual suggestion, is that when it first came up on my feed, I saw the feature image, which actually shows Campsober chasing Dylan Piraeus in possession. I thought, well, you know, if Dylan Piraeus got a move to set, that would actually be quite interesting. Like, that could maybe work. Yeah. But then I read the article and saw it was Campsober, and I was like,
interesting.
Yes, that's a bit different.
Elvis Campsober has also almost never played on the right flank this season. He's mainly played on the left.
I like
or
that
in
that's your favourite logical inconsistency
no,
to
just,
this.
I mean, but
not the source,
that
not the name
be
of the
available,
website.
Like a cursory glance. Anyway, whatever.
Well, I think anytime you're linking Elvis Camps over to Celtic, that's probably the as good of a sign as you could possibly get that you need to move somewhere else.
Hey, who knows? Maybe this is true. Maybe Ange sees something
okay.
in him that nobody else does.
Not a bad point. Maybe this is true. Maybe it makes us look.
Imagine
like
Elvis doing his backflip celebration in front of the in front of. A packed Celtic Park.
Like that would actually be good. I would enjoy that part. Also, as a Hearts fan who plays Celtic on the opening day, really crossing my fingers that they do play and start camp sober because it would be very funny. But if it did happen, it would make us look like fools. And speaking of people and teams that have made us look like fools, Josh, I think it's a pretty good way to get into some Euros chat because yeah. there's one national team that is making you – And many other pundits, in fairness, look very stupid. And that's a team that lost 3-1 overnight and are out without a single point. Turkey. Where did it all go wrong, JP?
I don't know. I really thought going into this tournament that they were going to continue their qualifying form. Defensively, so resilient. They were absolutely incredible in qualifying. They were impenetrable at the back, and Burak Yılmaz was in the form of his life, age 35. The other thing I used as a predictor, which obviously went horribly wrong, was the fact that a lot of good international sides have been based on the core of a few club players playing together, and they had a little core. So they've just won Ligue 1 with three players, a right-back, central midfielder, and Yılmaz up front.
Yeah.
All starting for that little team and all playing together for Turkey as well. And I thought that was a great sign of team cohesion, especially combined with their really good qualifying record. I didn't think they were going to be super fun to watch, but I thought they'd get results. And they've just been horrendous. They have had no way to move the ball through midfield whatsoever. I don't think Hakan Çalhanoğlu has really done his chances of an AC Milan contract extension any good.
Yeah, that's the craziest part of it for me. It's like this is, you know, for Hakan, this is your chance to, you know, he's got maybe one big money move left in his career as a free agent. Like this is yeah. it. This is last chance saloon for him in terms of making bank, for want of a better expression. And he's completely flopped.
He just kind of sucks on the wing, though. They've been playing him on the left wing the entire time, and he's way better as a 10. He's way better as a 10 because he doesn't have to rely on his pace that doesn't exist.
Yeah. One interesting point as well is like there's not just you know difference in position, but the way that Milan play is like very structured, lots of patterns, and then Çalhanoğlu is like the exception. He's sort of the one with the creative license, can do the chaotic stuff. Whereas
it's all about final ball for him as well.
Exactly. Whereas you chuck him in a Turkey side where the whole thing is chaos, it just does not translate at all. So Turkey are the public enemy number one of the football pundit sphere.
I will put a caveat. They have been poor, but. And they've come up against three sides who've brought their absolute best football on each of those three occasions. Italy, second half, as soon as they got the breakthrough, were breathtaking in that first game in Rome. Wales had their best tournament performance since the 2016, well, best performance full stop, I should say, since the 2016 Euros when they played against them there. Gareth Bale was in absolutely inspired form. Aaron Ramsey was ripping it apart. It was, from 1 to 11, just a magnificent Wales performance. And then Switzerland really brought it in this game as well. I mean, I don't think Turkey did themselves any favours with their transition defending. And they really had to risk going forward, committing numbers forward in this game, which has never been the way that they've played in qualifying.
Yeah, well, you saw that the minute they really pushed the pace after they got that
they
goal
conceded
back.
Straight away.
Yeah, exactly.
They conceded straight away. So, yeah. But the quality of the finishing for Switzerland, some of those goals, I mean, Shaqiri was amazing in this fixture. He could have had a hat-trick. He should have.
Of the evening, definitely the game for the neutral watcher.
I should have watched this game instead of Italy. I don't know why I watched second-string Italy grind out a boring 1-0 against 10-man
Josh,
Wales.
If it makes you feel any better, you weren't the only one made to look silly from last night's results because Turkey embarrassed you, but I was also embarrassed by the fact that the opening scorer for this game was none other than Haris Seferovic, a player I described privately to you as the best worst striker I've ever seen.
He's been a figure of sort of fascination and fun for us.
Yeah, it's so strange because he's clearly got a few ideas about how he fits in, what he should be doing with back to goal. But when it comes to the actual general play, solid, not bad. But when it comes to the actual nuts and bolts of what makes a striker, he's just so bad. He's terrible at finishing.
He looks so hapless. He looks like, is it Cameron from Ferris Bueller's Day Off? It looks like everything would just the worst possible thing would always happen to him. That's why how I felt about him in major tournaments. He's just a bad luck Brian of international
football. He just feels tacked on. Like he feels like the weird key, the novelty key ring you add to all the other important keys that are in there. But anyway, Switzerland leave themselves a good chance of qualifying as a third place team. A pretty decent chance.
I think they will. I think 4 points should be enough.
We'll be ashamed to see them eventually lose their third place privileges to Scotland, who are obviously beating Croatia in a few days' time. On Thursday morning, it's definitely happening. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about
if
that.
Scotland
group
win by a goal, then it's going to be interesting.
They will win, so they will have to win by a goal.
Yeah, but if Scotland win by a goal, they'll still be down on goals scored, depending on the scoreline.
Well,
it's going to be even goal difference.
Just have to tell Lyndon. So you're going to have to score two or
three.
You're
going to have to beat Croatia by two to finish ahead of Switzerland in the rankings. I don't think Switzerland are the third place team to beat, honestly. I think there'll be other teams finishing on two and 3 points.
Well, above them is Wales, who went down 1-0 to Italy last night, a second string Italy. This was a bit of a weird game.
Yeah, Verratti was very good. He was the highlight of watching it. Seeing him back fully fit. I don't think he was even fully fit, to be honest, but he still tore it up. Very, very good set-piece delivery on the goal. It was really unorthodox, low, whipped cross, and Pessina only had to give it a little flick at the near post and went straight in. I think Wales had their best chance of the game after Ampadu got sent off, didn't they? When did the Bale chance come?
Yeah, yeah, I think it was after that.
He just has to score that. I mean, he's 8 yards out. I mean, the player that you want it to fall to the most on his left foot from so close with nobody even near him. Yeah. I mean, Gareth Bale just has to put that in the back of the net.
I know the logic doesn't quite translate, but it is always very strange to me when you see a player who is well known for scoring spectacular goals, and in particular, the goal in the Champions League final against Liverpool.
Yeah.
Like, not saying that that was an easy chance that he had, but for him to then miss, for a player to then miss a comparatively easier chance to this complete wonder goal that they've scored. I always just find that so funny. Like, I always get that feeling with Zlatan, like, if he misses a chance, not that it happens too often, I'm like, you've scored a bicycle kick from, like, 30-plus yards. Surely this is just, you can do this blindfolded. But, as you said, Marco Verratti bossed this game. Does present a problem for Italy, however, in terms of how they balance that midfield, because obviously, Locatelli was the player who dropped out, and Locatelli has been very good in this tournament so far. Fun fact, Locatelli has had more shots on target this tournament than England, than the nation of England.
That's pretty funny.
The nation of England. That's how good he has been, drifting in and out of those deep midfield positions.
I don't see how you can start Locatelli and Verratti together. I mean, unless Jorginho drops, but Jorginho is the only player from Italy to start three games in the midfield. Yeah. So surely he's not going to be rotated. I think the player in danger of being dropped for Verratti is probably Barella.
Really?
Yeah, well, I mean,
He was
the player that all the buzz was about pre-tournament, what a young player, what a young prospect. But I think he's been the worst performing of the four. I mean, Jorginho is structurally crucial. I don't think Mancini is going to drop him in a million years.
Yeah.
And then Locatelli's been the surprise standout. I think Locatelli, Verratti, Jorginho is a fantastic combination. Locatelli's got that box-to-box energy and the goal-scoring ability. Verratti's got the technique and the creativity, and Jorginho keeps the tempo going, recycles possession, plays as that shield in front of the back four. I mean, it's very aggressive, I know, and you don't get Barella's pressing and his defensive side of his game, but I just don't... I just don't think Locatelli can be dropped after his performance in the second group game.
Yeah, I think that's probably the pleasing thing, is that as much as, you know, what Barella is able to provide is pretty important to breaking down teams, especially if you play a more compact system, Locatelli has shown in some way with his forward progression that, like, he can kind of, you know, fill in that sort of, you know, third man run kind of role. And if, you know, you're able to squeeze in Jorginho and Verratti either side of him, like, that's a pretty formidable setup, you know, even with Barella on the pine. Like, it's a difficult decision to have to make for Mancini, but equally very good problem to have.
I've had someone ask me in the Twitch who I'm rooting for. I don't know. I don't really have a team in the Euros.
Football. Football's always the winner. As a, who says that?
Sounds like a Partridgeism.
No, it does sound like a Partridgeism. It's not.
I'll let you ponder that. The only European nation I've got a vague connection to is Sweden, but they're so boring. So boring. I'm not Swedish. I just lived there for a couple of years when I was a baby.
Yeah, well, Aussie has saying how crazy is Group E. It has been pretty crazy. It's been pretty wild.
It has been. I think Spain are not as bad as people are making out. It's as if this is a complete catastrophe and, you know, they're complete frauds and they're so boring and so on and so forth. They're creating more chances than anybody else. They've got the highest XG of any of the teams after two group games, not including the teams that have played their third. I think Italy would obviously top that just because, you know, accumulated. But they've created, I think, 6 point something XG.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just Morata. It's literally just Morata. People say that tiki-taka is outdated. Yes, it is, but I still think it can work in international football where tactics sort of lag several years behind. They say that Spain are not vertical enough and, you know, they play too slowly. That's probably true, but they still should have won both of these games. I really don't think it's as big a catastrophe as people are making out. It's just the fact that they don't have a striker who can put the ball in the net. Moreno, with his misses as well, didn't inspire confidence. Maybe you throw in Adama Traore in the mix in the front line just to change the pace of the play a little bit in this third game.
Maybe just someone that requires a bit more defensive attention and frees up a Moreno or a Morata for more efforts on goal. But the sort of difficult thing is, while, as you said, and I agree with you, I think they've been better than their results suggest and their chance creation has been good, but a player who's having a difficult time finding the back of the net, it's not really something that you can turn around overnight.
Oh, they might go out. They might get eliminated, but it's not because the team's bad. It's just because they can't score.
Yeah.
Just because they can't finish, I should say.
I mean, how realistic of a possibility is it that, you know, they don't get the result that they need against Slovakia?
I think they'll beat Slovakia. Come on.
But we said that about the other teams in the group.
I mean, in fairness,
Slovakia is of the opponents, the lowest, the easiest of the beats, but still.
I just can't see them not beating
I'm saying,
Slovakia.
Just to be clear, I'm saying this as someone who tipped Spain to make the final. So I'm going against my own interest by suggesting it. But don't count it out. Sardine saying Spain versus England would send the crowd to sleep. Well, prepare to sleep because it's not a bad possibility.
Well, I need to catch up on some sleep, actually. So that might be a good idea. I'm rooting for that fixture. Lockie, what didn't we talk about from the weekend? I think Germany.
Yeah.
We have to address Germany. Should we take a quick message from our sponsors and talk the resurgent Yogi Löw Germany side on the other side of this game?
Break? I'm quite happy to avoid talking about Germany as much as possible because they made me look quite silly. So we'll have a little sponsor interlude, I think. The Germans are coming, Josh.
The Germans
are coming. That's what the Portuguese defence was saying. Well, specifically one German, Robin Gosens, was coming and causing them a lot of problems.
Gosens.
Gosens?
Gosens.
Gosens.
I've really done the research, the hard yards on finding the pronunciation. I've heard about 16 different ways of saying that. There's no umlaut. You do say the G. It's Gorsens.
Okay. Well, in any case...
consider yourself informed.
He was, in any case, he was Sir Good. That's me trying to claw back some German respectability against Portugal. And they just did not have an answer, Josh.
No, it was a very strange game. Two own goals. I mean, own goal has been in great form this tournament. A lot more prolific than Alvaro Morata. Yeah, it's, I think it's almost the top scorer in the tournament, isn't it? Five own goals so far?
Yikes.
Four of them have been almost exactly the same as well.
Yeah, always a good sell for a tournament, isn't it? When they've all, the own goal is
we just
the
can't stop
scorer.
Scoring ourselves. It's almost always been an action replay of a ball in behind a fullback, a low cross hammered across the area, and then just a ricochet off an unlucky defender
and
into an empty
not
net.
Dealing with it at all.
So yeah. Hummels against France, there were the two this time, Rafael Guerreiro and Ruben Dias. There was also Demiral in the first game, Italy. All
yes, that's
pretty
right.
much the exact same goal in action replay, whether it was a cross in for the left or right. I don't know what that says tactically about the tournament. I'm sure there's some like profound conclusion we could come to. Maybe that the fullbacks are pressing too high and it leaves you vulnerable to a ball over the top.
I think with respect to this game, it's certainly not an unreasonable way of looking things. I mean, Nelson Semedo and you know, Rafael Guerreiro, the way they're instructed to play, they do like to push up quite a lot, get themselves forward, get involved in the attack, does provide that space in behind, which Robin
Gorsens
used to full effect against Portugal, who you had tipped as winners for this tournament. Are there panic stations in the Portuguese nation, Josh?
I don't think so. This was a very specific tactical foible that befell Portugal. I do think the Portuguese coach is a little bit too conservative for his own good, but I say that about a lot of national coaches. But it was the width that Germany were playing with, the two wing-backs. I don't know if any other nation at this tournament plays with wing-backs as creative and as attack-minded as Germany does. Certainly not in a 3-4-3. So that was switching the ball from one side to the other. Portugal are instructed to basically defend the width of their penalty area, and also their fullbacks get pretty high in possession because they lack penetration from central midfield, so they have to get numbers forward somehow. Playing Carvalho and Danilo in the same midfield, I think, is unsustainable.
I don't think either of us are a huge fan of that comp.
I just think Danilo Pereira has to be dropped. They've got too many good, creative central midfielders and attackers to leave them both plugging up that midfield with their extremely slow, lumbering defensive work. Carvalho is, I think, a smarter player than Danilo. I think he makes up for his lack of pace with good positional awareness. Danilo is just a physical presence, and I really don't think he should be playing international football, in all honesty. I think he's completely overrated at a club level. I don't know why PSG signed him. Maybe it was just a Leonardo sabotaging Tuchel transfer, but I was stunned that he went to such a big club. So anyway, going back to the tactical setup, I mean, Germany did play well in this game, but it was just because their biggest strength was also Portugal's biggest weakness.
But does it not, you know, you mentioned the conservatism of Fernando Santos before. The fact that that was Portugal's biggest, maybe if it's their biggest weakness, that he's sort of throwing his hands up and saying, you know, there's nothing I can do to change this. But it was very obvious from early on in this game that Portugal were getting slaughtered down the flanks because of that attacking output that the wing backs were providing. And it just was this weird situation where at no point did Santos seem to react to that in this game.
Yeah, like he just was like very passive, wasn't it?
Yeah, was it sort of he tried to change something and it wasn't obvious to me, or was it a case of him realizing there's not really much we can do about this? Because if other teams are seeing this who have got decent fullbacks who can push forward and attack. I mean, France have certainly got, you know, we've seen that they have their own issues defensively, but we've seen that they've certainly got two fullbacks who can do a good job of bombing forward and causing a threat from wide areas. Would teams not be looking at this and sort of seeing, well, if they can't make a change to rectify this situation, then obviously this presents a pretty good way to causing them trouble.
Yeah, I think the other problem in this game was also Kroos and Gundogan had too much time on the ball. They were always able to get at least one of them free, and that's something that they didn't have in the France game. France were putting a lot more pressure on in central midfield with Kante. Pogba actually did a great job defensively in that game, which is something we don't often say about him. So if you give Toni Kroos 10 yards to play raking long switches, then he's going to kill you. If you press him, then he's nowhere near as effective. So Portugal just played too deep, they played too narrow, and they are obviously brilliant on the counter-attack, but when you're playing so close to your own goal and just sort of shrinking and almost turtling, going into your shell, if Germany will punish you. They do move the ball very well from side to side, and I thought they really prepared well for this game. I think Portugal's setup complemented what they were doing, but I was really impressed with Thomas Muller. I just thought he's so intelligent with his movement, but also just it's so obvious that he's giving instructions to everybody else on the field. But
when are you like really? When are you not impressed by Thomas Muller? And I'm not saying that about you specifically. I just mean that generally. Like anytime you watch that guy move around off the ball, like he's one of the only. I don't really like watching just an individual player for a whole game. Like I'm not. Back in the early 2010s A-League days, I was never a big advocate of the Heskey cam, for example, just looking at one player. But I would pay premium to have that for Thomas Muller, to just watch that guy go around and do his thing, because he is so, so intelligent.
Well, and if he's not on screen, you can usually hear him.
Yeah.
He's always shouting.
And thank God we can hear and see him, because the way the German national team were having problems with him and Mats Hummels as well, it very nearly wasn't the case. And I think Germany are a massive beneficiary of that particular about-face.
I'm not sure that bringing Hummels back was the best idea, in all honesty, but bringing Muller back definitely helps them. He actually, I don't know if you're aware of his nickname, Lucky. Not Raum Deuter, the other
not
one.
Space Investigator.
No, Space Interpreter.
Space Interpreter, my bad.
He's also known as Radio Muller, just because he never shuts up on the pitch. He's been like that since his youth team days.
I like that.
So it's almost like having an extra coach out there, which I think Jogi Löw these days needs as much coaching help as possible. So
yeah, well, Germany play Hungary on Thursday morning at 5 a.m., that one running concurrently with the France-Portugal game, which is the neutral's delight.
Did
I
you
guess.
Notice the ground announcer in the Hungary game getting rudely interrupted and slightly terrified by the Hungarian celebrations?
Yes, I did notice that.
So good. Apparently the player who scored tried to run and celebrate in front of the crowd, but he realised he'd run to the wrong part and he'd run straight in front of the France fans, so he had to improvise.
See, the still lingering in the memory, Emmanuel Adebayor just says, you know, if you get to that end of the field,
you may as well.
You may, you know, if you realise the France fans are over there and you can't celebrate with the fans of your native nation, just do a massive knee slide in front of them. No, I mean, I've seen worse ideas. But you're not giving Hungary any chance of an upset?
I definitely would. If they can play
Does lightning strike twice?
If they can play with the same intensity that they've brought to these two games, I think sometimes in the third group game when you've got a thin squad, you can't rotate as much, it can drop off. They've been riding a sort of emotional wave with the support of the crowd and the home games and so forth. Against Germany, I think they will tire out a little quicker just because of the accumulated fatigue. So I would lean towards Germany in this game, getting the job done pretty comfortably. But I definitely wouldn't rule them out getting a result. I don't think they're going to win. I don't think they're going to do enough to get through.
Aussie Hez saying, boys, does Mats Hummels look like Nick or what? How many strong featured players is Nick Debano going to get compared to?
I think every person in the world with a sort of vague, like goatee beard gets compared to Nick DeBarney.
Yeah, if you have the sort of Guy Fawkes mask sort of mustache look.
You know who looks like Nick? Bryan Cranston in Breaking Bad. No, not really. But
anyway.
Is the danger.
Final item of the evening, Josh. We talked about a cup set or a potential upset for Hungary. There may be another one brewing tomorrow night at Lakeside in the FFA Cup.
Well, the dilemma for Preston Macedonia fans and players is whether they stay up and watch this North Macedonia-Netherlands game at 2 a.m. the night before a cup game. I think players might be forbidden from doing so. But fantastic to see this game finally go ahead. Really big occasion for the Preston Lions against Oakley Cannons. Lakeside Stadium, unfortunately, they won't have the benefit of the thousands of Preston fans who are planning to attend. But, you know, even more viewers for the live stream. So I'm sure the social media metrics will be off the charts. Mm. You saw Oakley play on the weekend. They got out of jail late with a Joe Knowles injury time winner. What did you make of them? Do you think they're kind of firing and in the sort of form where this game will cause them no problems, or do you feel Preston's got a real shot?
I didn't think so. I mean, really, with the greatest of respect to Altona, they've probably been comparable in quality to a outfit like the Preston Lions this season with how much they've struggled.
Two divisions between the two clubs.
Yeah, obviously. So. Oakley took the lead. They looked fairly comfortable. They were turning on the pressure. But then when Nick Sete scored with the aid of a deflection, it really rattled. Like it seemed to rattle Oakley a bit. Maybe there was periods of that game where their fitness and their energy levels were being managed with the cup game in mind. It certainly seemed as though Oakley would have periods where they'd push forward and really press the issue and sort of get ascendancy, and then maybe they score one goal, or maybe after about 10 or 15 minutes, they dropped off, and Altona became the ones who were pushing the pace, which is a very rare thing to have to see in this season. I mean, John McShane scored at 2-all. The funny thing is that at 2-all, when John McShane got that equaliser at the near post, for quite some time, did look as though Altona were the most likely to maybe grab a third before Joe Knowles pulled what I can only describe as an absolute bender out of the hat at an empty Jack Edwards reserve. An awesome goal. But interestingly, they played this game without Joe Guest because
he played in the 10 role.
That's a good question. There was a lot of rotating. Holmes was still... I thought I would have expected that Holmes would push forward and occupy that role perhaps, because I think one of the problems that maybe Oakley's had this season is that Holmes and Guest can maybe get in each other's way a little bit from an ideological perspective. I think Holmes is playing that deeper role but is maybe suited to being further afield in the spaces that Joe Guest occupies. I thought he would have been pushed forward in this game, but he wasn't. But no Joe Guest. As I understand, Joe Guest will not be playing tomorrow night because he's still in quarantine.
It's huge.
He's in home quarantine. He was in the. He lives in that South Bank hotel where the most recent outbreak in Victoria has been occurring. So he's stuck at home for the next 14 days, and I'm pretty sure he is not available tomorrow night. Which is, yeah. I remember weeks ago when this game was going to be held, the discussion around, oh, Preston have got injuries, you know, this is a really tough one. But now 3 weeks have passed, Preston have got a chance to bring a few players back into the fold, and one of, you know, he hasn't been as good this season, Joe Guest, in my personal opinion, but still one of their most important players for Oakley is gone from this fixture.
Couple of injury concerns for Preston, nowhere near as bad as when this game was originally rescheduled. So they've got James Harron back and a lot of the defenders available again, which is great. I do think they're going to miss Andrea Roksandic if he can't get back from this groin issue he came off with on the weekend. He does shield the back four, and in a game like this, you really want him there. So I think they're going to miss his influence, and I'm not sure if James Poole will be back in time. Apparently he was suffering from a tight calf, didn't play against Melbourne City. So his creativity will be sorely missed if they can't get him fit in time. But they've still got most of their first-choice selection available, so I would give them a real, real shot at Lakeside. It's definitely an uphill battle against a side two divisions above them with way bigger resources, but they will give it absolutely everything. Make sure you tune in from 7:30 p.m. It's going to be on the Football Victoria pages, I think, rather than the NPL Victoria page. Hopefully the FFA Cup channel will share it as well, but myself and Tao on the call, I'm really looking forward to it. And tonight, if you want some more NPL Victoria chat, the Night Train is back from 8 p.m. They had a thrilling win over Hume City on the weekend, so tune in for the Night Train. We'll sign off for now. It's been Twilight Football with me, Josh Parrish, and Lockie Flanagan.